Friday. You know what that means, right? The past 5 days in the global economy in 4 blistering minutes of live radio from American Public Media. This is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. The 16th of October today. Great to have you along on this Friday, everybody. And let us not dilly-dally, shall we? Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. She is in New York. Felix Salmon works for Fusion. He is here live and in person. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. Too bad you couldn't have made it, Lee. We could have had a little party.
I'm just saying.
All right.
I feel bad.
That's all right. So we got a bunch of stuff I got to rattle through here in like 4.5 minutes. Felix, we're going to start with you. I want to talk about intra-Fed bickering. Members of the Federal Open Market Committee have come out this week, and a couple of them said, oh, we got to raise rates. A couple of them said, oh, no, we don't have to. What is one to make of that?
I think that Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, is a collegial kind of person, and she actually encourages her board of governors to have their own opinions and to talk these things through, and I think that's great. And Lael Brainard, who's one of the younger members of the committee, is very smart, and she's saying, look at what's happened to the dollar. The dollar is so strong right now, that's effectively the same as tightening, so maybe we don't need to tighten.
So, Lee, but the question is, do you think the Fed is adding to the economic sort of uncertainty that's out there, right? We got the debt limit, we got global economy is shaky, and now we have the Fed saying, oh, we're going to raise, no, we're not. Oh, we're going to raise, no, we're not.
Yeah, I think they're adding to it. I mean, everything is uncertain. I feel like ever since August, things have gotten a lot more uncertain. And so nobody knows. And the fact that they're being saying that much, I mean, other than making you think, wow, it's almost like a Fed reality show. Would that be interesting? Because they're always so opaque. But it is uncertain. But I think in uncertain times, they err on the side of caution. And I think that's what we'll see.
The real world, the Fed edition. Felix, let me ask you a somewhat technical question. Some of the blather this week on the Fed has been, ooh, they missed their window to raise rates. Help me understand that.
I have no idea.
All right.
It makes no sense to me at all. They can raise or not raise whenever they like. I guess the idea was that the economy was looking good and they could have raised. Now it's not looking quite as good, and so now they shouldn't raise. But if they had raised, they wouldn't be cutting. So that was a brief
all
window.
Right, you're making my brain hurt. Yeah. All right. Last thing on the Fed, Lee, and rates. There is, we learned again this week with the CPI and with the producer price index, wholesale and retail inflation. There is still no inflation in this economy. Just doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist, and I don't think we should count on it happening anytime soon. But I think a lot weighs on the jobs number. I do think that there's a chance that things could look up again if we get a strong jobs number.
Always does.
Yes.
Felix, this has been the week of big deals, right? We've got Dell EMC.
The largest leverage buyout of all time.
I know, which is kind of amazing. And also the big beer thing with SAB Miller and Anheuser-Busch InBev. Is that a positive sign that things are good and companies feel confident enough? Or is it just that money is free and we're going to, as you said, lever ourselves up and buy stuff because we can?
It certainly means that Wall Street's making lots of money. There's every single bank in the world is involved in this Dell EMC deal, and they're going to make hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars on fees, the loans, the bonds. It's financial engineering. I don't think there's any real effect on the real world, but certainly the financial engineers are loving it.
Lee, do I care as a person in this economy that these big deals are happening?
I agree with Felix. I mean, M&A activity has been surging all year. Huge. I think if you look at the public markets, things are not looking so good. And I think that doesn't bode very well, especially for the 142 unicorns that at some point are going to need to make some kind of gallop somewhere.
All those companies worth $1 billion. Speaking of companies and unicorns worth $1 billion and all of this, we learned this morning that Steve Ballmer, the guy who got Microsoft stuck in the mud, in my humble opinion, for years, has a 4% stake in Twitter, and everybody went, oh my God, this is incredible. Felix, what?
This is hashtag billionaire whimsy, right? If you have $21 billion, you can afford $800 million to spend on Twitter stock. I think it's a sports thing. He likes the idea that Twitter is like live sports. He owns the LA Clippers. But no, I mean, it's silly.
Lee, thoughts on Twitter and Ballmer?
It's always interesting. I think it's always interesting when you learn, you know, who's behind these huge stakes. And I also think, you know, he really specifically endorsed the very two points of Jack Dorsey's new strategy, operating leaner and Twitter moments. And so it's a real endorsement of Dorsey after all this mishigas whether he is the right person.
If Steve Ballmer is the only person who likes Twitter moments, then
is, right? I mean, of the three of us, let's take a survey. Anybody? Raise your hand. Anybody like Twitter moments? Yeah,
that's actually silence. The 3 million people. None of who listen to this. None of them.
6 million, but you know, who's
6 million. None of them like it. It's a complete flop.
Felix Salmon is at Fusion. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. None of us like Twitter moments. They ought to get rid of it, or at least get us the ability to get rid of that blue dot, for crying out loud. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you soon. Honestly, on Wall Street today, traders might as well have taken the day off for all the difference they made. Details, numbers, you know the drill. It has not, generally speaking, been a great quarter for the big Wall Street banks. Earnings were this week distinctly meh, one might say, especially for Goldman Sachs. They still made plenty of money, don't get me wrong, in the billions of dollars, but all told 36% less money than the same quarter last year. Investors have been asking for a while now whether Goldman still has the right business mix, the right model with its heavy reliance on trading of pretty much anything, and whether it's the right model for this post-Great Recession world. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
First, keep in mind, this is one quarter when global financial markets were chaotic, so it was tough for everyone, and especially tough for Goldman Sachs, where trading is a big part of their business. Still, says analyst Michael Wong at Morningstar, there is a real question whether Goldman should still be so dependent on trading when its peers mostly aren't.
Definitely at least two camps in regards to fixed income, currencies, and commodities trading, and whether large banks should be investing more in them or scaling back.
In Goldman's case, Wong is in the camp of, if it ain't broke, or at least it wasn't until last quarter, don't fix it. He points out Goldman had blockbuster returns until this summer, and if rival banks in the U.S. and Europe are backing away from trading, that actually creates an opportunity.
If Goldman Sachs is able to gain market share, that should be positive for the firm.
But Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says the ground is shifting under Goldman Sachs. Sweeping new financial regulations mean the bank has to hold more capital. Their bond trading is limited. Everything's scrutinized by regulators looking for risky market plays.
The way Goldman Sachs knows how to make above-market returns is to take above-market risks. But when the rules won't let you take those above-market risks, you've got a very significant long-term challenge.
Still, becoming a retail bank with ATMs and auto loans and all the rest, that's going to be hard for Goldman. And Petru says the bank actually is innovating in areas like online lending and payments processing ahead of some of its rivals. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If anybody ever tells you that politics isn't a business, you just tell them to go pound sand, all right? We got the latest numbers last night on how much the various and sundry presidential candidates pulled in last quarter. So there's the first business parallel, quarterly profits of a sort. The 22 presidential campaigns have raised about $274 million so far, a tidy haul. But there is, though, another number we ought to look at, the second business indicator. It's something called the burn rate. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains why it's important and what it tells us about the campaigns.
It's all well and good to raise a lot of money, but it also matters how fast you spend it.
Burn rate is just the rate at which you're burning dollars.
Katie Packer is with Burning Glass, a Republican consulting firm. So take two candidates like Bernie Sanders and Ben Carson. Both raised more than $20 million, but Carson is spending much faster. Packer says the right amount of money spent in the right way will keep a campaign warm and cozy with enough fuel to last through the cold election season.
Conventional wisdom is that you need to hold on to your cash as much as possible until you get very, very close to the time when voters are starting to cast their vote for a candidate.
Burn through money too quickly and risk your campaign going up in smoke. But finding the middle ground isn't easy.
Well, budgeting in political campaigns is a delicate balancing act.
Kostas Panagopoulos is a political science professor at Fordham University.
Candidates do have to spend money early on so that they can introduce themselves effectively and build upon that recognition as the campaign goes on.
Because TV ads won't get any cheaper the closer we get to the primaries. And donors also look at burn rates to see how candidates are spending their money. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
New York and Broadway have become exciting tourist attractions, glimmering, shimmering places.
There is, it turns out, no business like show business. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 0.4% on this Friday, 74 points, 17,215 at the bell for the blue chips. The NASDAQ picked up 0.3%, 16 points, 48.86. The S&P 500 gained 0.4%, 9 points, 2,033. There, for the week gone by, the Dow finished up ahead 0.8%. The NASDAQ advanced 1.2%. The S&P 500 rose 0.9%. On the earnings front, General Electric charged up 3.5% despite reporting a big drop in quarterly profits. The industrial giant beat analysts' expectations. Mattel reported a lousy quarter yesterday and got pounded after the bell, but the toy company regained 6% today. No such luck, though, for Wynn Resorts, which continued yesterday's post-earnings slide. The casino operator shed another percent on this Friday. If you're wondering about Microsoft and Steve Ballmer and Twitter and all that stuff, news that Ballmer has a 4% stake in Twitter. That is, by the way, more than Jack Dorsey, the guy who runs the company. It helped push the stock up nearly 5%, and it is party time at SFX Entertainment. The rave operator sparkled up 12% on news that it might be bought. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. On the theory that you can never slice the content-seeking audience too thin, there is yet another new video streaming service out there. It's from NBC Universal, and it's focusing on comedy, offering NBC's library of shows like SNL and The Tonight Show in a service that they are calling CISO. Yes, CISO. Anyway, NBC says they are also going to have 20 original shows, all for the low, low price of $4 a month. For some, though, that may be $4 too many, as Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains.
If you're cord cutting, getting rid of cable TV, you're probably replacing it with streaming options. So let's count up our pennies, shall we? Broadband, say $65 a month. Maybe Netflix, about $10. Then there's Hulu, Amazon Prime, HBO Now, Showtime, now NBC. And I'm sorry, where are the savings again?
There's really not much saving.
That's analyst Eric Brannon of IHS, and he actually keeps track of all those subscription video on demand services that are competing for your pennies.
My count is 97 as of this month.
Yes, 97 different services. Digital media analyst Colin Dixon of Endscreen Media says the TV industry is chasing young viewers who are disappearing.
If this group leave the fold and don't connect with people like NBC, they may never connect with them.
This fall, network TV show ratings are down almost 12% among young men and almost 7% among young women. To reach them again, broadcasters need data, says James McQuivy of Forrester Research. And you get that data, he says, from streaming customers.
Collecting data tells us what video to serve them next so we can keep them watching.
And what shows to create in the future. As for NBC's CISO, can a comedy-only service compete with all those other streaming options?
It's a tougher sell, but it's probably the one shot they have to make this work.
Because, McQuivy says, NBC's comedy library is pretty strong and may be good enough a draw in a crowded field. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
There's been a lot of bad news out of the Chicago public school system lately. Former CEO Barbara Bird Bennett pleaded guilty to fraud for accepting kickbacks this week. The district started the year with a $500 million hole in its budget, and teachers are threatening to strike for the second time in 3 years. But all of that said, in the longer term, the past decade or so, Chicago has dramatically increased the number of students graduating and going on to college. So from our education desk, Marketplace's Amy Scott looks at how that story has played out at one school on the city's far southeast side.
When it's time to change classes at George Washington High School, students don't just get a bell. They get U2. Ariana Aguilera is a senior.
So it's really fun to have music in the background because a lot of us listen to music on a regular basis, so it kind of just pumps us up.
That's the kind of energy Principal Kevin Gallick and his team were looking to create when they arrived at the high school 3 years ago. Washington is a predominantly Hispanic school in a working-class neighborhood. When Gallick started, just 65% of students graduated on time, and only 35% of them went to college.
We knew that this 35% alone made us even abnormal in Chicago. And so it was something that we wanted to focus on right away.
But creating a college-going culture at Washington would take some doing. For decades, this part of the city had been a manufacturing hub. Kids could walk across the street after graduation and get a good job at a steel mill. By the 1990s, most of those jobs were gone, but Gallick says the school hadn't adapted.
We were talking about, you know, redefining what a high school is supposed to be about, and the bottom line is Washington was a little bit behind the times.
To catch up, Gallick started making college part of the conversation at Washington. The school staged a phone-a-thon, reaching out to parents to answer their questions about applications and financial aid. On ACT testing day, the Rocky theme played over the intercom. Assistant Principal Anthony Malcolm even passed out T-shirts like the one John Belushi wore in Animal House that just said college.
I'm telling you, we would come out of here on Fridays and be driving home and you'd see a kid wearing their college T-shirt. And we were like, yes.
Gallick also ramped up the academics, bringing in more literacy and AP classes. The school used data to keep a closer watch on students' grades and attendance and enlisted virtually every adult in the building, including security guards, coaches, and teachers, to mentor students individually. At first, Gallick says, it was hard for some teachers to swallow. They were busy enough just trying to keep the students in their classes from falling behind.
Teachers weren't saying, yes, I think this is my job to support kids to go to college. It wasn't really the role at the time.
Gradually, he says, they got on board. History teacher George Fotopoulos says he starts talking with his students about college at the very beginning of ninth grade.
I kind of let the kids know that, you know, we're here in school to support them. We all want to see them graduate in 4 years. We all want them to succeed and move on and, you know, do something in higher education.
Gabriel Fuentes is a Washington graduate who's now a counselor at the school.
Now we felt that we had a lot more ammunition to help these students because now it wasn't just being talked about in a counseling session. It was being talked about in a classroom or with a coach. Everyone was speaking the same language.
The extra support freed counselors up to work more closely with students like Ariana Aguilera to find the right schools and complete financial aid forms.
I'm looking into Northwestern, University of Chicago, and Knox College.
Even straight-A students like Ariana need a lot of guidance with applications and financial aid forms.
The school has a lot of support, so it's really helpful and you don't feel like you're left all alone.
Remember, 3 years ago, only 35% of Washington graduates went to college. The numbers for last year's seniors aren't in yet, but Principal Kevin Gallick estimates close to 70% of them are now in college.
And this is what happens when you have an intentional focus on students.
Similar strategies have paid off across the district. Eliza Moeller is an analyst with the Consortium on Chicago School Research at the University of Chicago. She says in 2013, about 61% of Chicago public school graduates enrolled in college.
We've essentially caught up to the U.S. average for students enrolling in college, and we're far poorer than the U.S. on average.
The big challenge now, Moeller says, is to make sure more of those students actually finish college. The consortium estimates that just 14% of ninth graders in Chicago public schools will earn a four-year degree by the time they're 25. In Chicago, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
If you go to Times Square today and you look up and down Broadway and all those streets in the mid-40s in Manhattan where the great old theaters are, it is quite honestly a little bit overwhelming, right? Lots of neon, crazy amounts of people, New Yorkers and tourists doing their own things. But it is also, according to Michael Riedel, the theater columnist for the New York Post, the beating economic heart of New York City. He writes about it all in his new book. It's called Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. Michael, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Kai.
You start this book with an author's note in which you say, Broadway, and this is the direct quote, its fractious band of colorful characters are as important to New York City as Wall Street, real estate, civic leaders, or politicians. I think I agree with you, but why do you say that?
Oh, well, because when New York City was careening towards bankruptcy in the early 70s, when Times Square was a dangerous, smutty place full of prostitutes and pimps, and no tourists, believe me, ever wanted to go to Times Square back then, when Broadway itself was falling apart, there were a handful of very colorful, egomaniacal, driven characters who loved the theater, who stuck by Broadway, who saved it, and in so doing, help lift the fortunes of Times Square and ultimately New York City itself.
Was there a moment you can point to that turned Times Square and Broadway from that thing that I remember from when I was a kid? My mom would like not let me walk through there when we went to Manhattan to see the Christmas plays, right? Was there a thing that turned it from that really unpleasant place to what it is today, which is honestly a tourist attraction?
Yeah, and also Broadway today is a multi-billion dollar global business. But I would say one of the watershed moments in the history of Broadway, but also New York City, is when a young choreographer went to Joe Papp, the great Joe Papp, who ran the Public Theater here in New York City. And this young guy, he brought with him a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he had spent a few nights with his friends, who were all dancers in the choruses of Broadway shows. And they got together, they cracked open a bottle of cheap wine, and they sat around and they talked about their lives. And he played those tapes for Joe Papp. And Joe Papp listened for about 15 minutes, and he said to this young guy, whose name was Michael Bennett, he said, I don't know what it is, but I'll give you some rehearsal space and a little money and go to work. And within a year, Michael Bennett created a show called A Chorus Line. And suddenly, there was something in Times Square, something on Broadway that people around the world wanted to see, and that was A Chorus Line.
See, I thought you were going to say Cats, and then I was just going to – we were going to have to end the interview because, oh, my God.
Well, allow me to make the case for Cats,
no,
all right?
No, no,
it's
no,
very,
please don't. Please,
it's very
please,
easy to slag off on Andrew Lloyd Webber, but he and Cameron McIntosh, the producer, without Cats, without Les Miserables, without The Phantom of the Opera, Broadway would not have turned around either. I mean, those were the shows that a company like Disney looked at, and Disney said, you know what? The initial investment in The Phantom of the Opera was something like – $6 million, but the worldwide gross is $4 billion. This is a business model that works.
Since you brought it up, Disney and Universal and the corporatization of American musical theater, that whole area of Manhattan, and isn't that a little bit, I don't know, sad? Or maybe that's false romanticism. I don't know.
I love A Chorus Line. I love My Fair Lady. I love the great old shows. But we can't live in the past. Beauty and the Beast may not have been my taste. The kind of corporate shows going on now may not be my taste. But I cannot argue with 13 million people coming to the city year in and year out going to see those shows. You know, I don't believe in condescending to people who are having a good time on Broadway.
Michael Riedel writes on theater for the New York Post. His recent book about the history of Broadway and Times Square and that whole area in Manhattan is called Razzle Dazzle. Michael, thanks very much.
Good to be with you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, you know, there are, and I'm using air quotes here, there are studies and reports out all the time talking about the costs of lost productivity in the workplace from all kinds of random things, right? Productivity losses from the NCAA basketball tournament, the Olympics, what have you. We've all seen them. And honestly, they are usually from sort of random groups looking for a little bit of press every now and then. But there was one out earlier this month from a more reputable institution, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, published in the American Journal of Preventive Health, talking about the productivity costs, the workplace productivity costs of excessive alcohol use. It's a lot. We are hungover at work to the tune of $77 billion a year, which is kind of amazing. All right, at the end of a not a whole lot going on Wall Street kind of week, we are out of here. The Dow up 0.4%, 74 points today. The NASDAQ up 0.3%, 16 points. The S&P 500 gained 0.4%. That is 9 points. The major indices all up for the week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we will see you Monday. This is APM.